The Day of Atonement certainly is different from all of other God's other holy days. Kind of unique, very special day actually for us in a number of respects, but a very special day for the rest of the world as well, even though they may not recognize it at this point in time. We certainly all recognize that this day is different, especially right now as we're all a little bit hungry. Atonement is included as one of God's holy days in Leviticus 23. And there, of course, we find those days are all lumped together and they're referred to as the feasts of the Lord. And of course, we afflict our souls on this day. And this day, of course, then is what we call actually the fifth step of God's master plan. It's not a feast that includes the enjoyment of physical foods, but rather it's one that focuses on some very important spiritual aspects. There are spiritual aspects that must occur in order for the kingdom of God to finally be established here on this earth. Now, God, of course, desires for all of us to come before Him today with a humble heart. He wants us to come with a humble heart and a right attitude. And fasting, of course, gets us in that mood. It gets our attention. It brings that about in us. You know, it humbles us. It helps us, of course, draw nearer to God and to recognize just how much we need Him. Mr. Lydon pointed out a scripture in Revelation 20, verses 1 through 3, where it talks about Satan being bound, being cast into the bottomless pit, and a seal put over him. That, of course, is one element of this day that we all recognize, an element that we look forward to. We might say, in one sense, it's that God's court has tried and sentenced Satan, and then that will be his actual, he'll then be serving his sentence when he's finally put into that pit and sealed up. Every year we keep this day in advance of the Feast of Tabernacles in the last great day. And we picture it, we do this to picture and learn the things that will take place after the return of Jesus Christ as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Things that must take place in order for the majority of mankind to be able to have for themselves, finally, a right relationship with God. So why does there need to be a change? That's kind of a silly question, I think, because we all know there needs to be a change. We look at this world around us, we see that it is indeed a very angry world that we live in. Everywhere they look, there's nothing but turmoil, there's hate, destruction, and violence just everywhere. Every year, it seems, just prior to the feast, and oftentimes even during the Feast of Tabernacles, there are violent storms that wreak havoc in various parts of the world. I don't know if you remember, just one year ago, we had Hurricane Harvey, which made landfall on August 25th. It came ashore near Port Aransas and Port O'Connor in Texas, along the Gulf Coast of Texas there. Caused tremendous destruction in those areas. Those two particular areas also caused severe flooding in the city of Houston and surrounding areas. You know, right after that, just a few days, there was Hurricane Irma. Hurricane Irma hit the Florida Keys. On August 10th, or September 10th, it came up, it hit Marco Island near Naples, Florida, very close to our Fort Myers feast site. Then proceeded on up the western Gulf Coast of the state of Florida, causing much destruction and much flooding. Next came Maria, another one, right on its heels. Beginning of September 18th, it hit several of the Caribbean islands, and especially did a tremendous amount of damage on Puerto Rico. Well, all of that happened last year, right before the feast. And this year, of course, just last week, we had Florence. Hurricane Florence has caused severe damage and extensive flooding in the Carolinas and the other areas of the eastern United States. And, of course, the huge typhoon there in the Philippines that we heard about during the announcements caused much destruction, much loss of life as well. You know, one good thing that does come from these situations, these storms that do hit us occasionally, it seems to bring out the best in a lot of people. And you see some of the stories on the news of many people have made tremendous sacrifices and at times even put themselves in harm's way to help those who are in need. And it's a wonderful thing to be able to see that and to recognize that there are people that do have good hearts and they do wonderful and generous things. So those are positive stories that can give us encouragement, even though there is much destruction that has taken place because of these events. in this world that is certainly filled with much despair, there are little bright lights that shine forth once in a while. Well, this time of year is called hurricane season. But these storms are evidence, of course, of Satan's fury as he does his best to keep God's people from observing God's holy days. He does this, seems to be, on a yearly basis, an annual basis every year. Satan hates God's feast days, and he especially hates this one, which pictures his demise. And these destructive elements that are increasing every year draw our attention to what is written in Revelation chapter 12. Revelation chapter 12 and verse 12. Revelation 12 and verse 12, the last part of the verse, it says, "Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you, having great wrath, because he knows that he has a short time." I think we can see evidence of his fury in these storms that seem to hit just before the feast every year. And as they increase in intensity and certainly in number over the years here, we probably recognize that Satan indeed realizes he has but a short time left. Well, these devastating events coming in such rapid succession probably, or they should in a way, remind us of the man Job. Now, we know the story of Job. We find in the beginning of the book that God asked Satan, he says, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil." And Satan responded to that by attacking Job's character, by saying the only reason that Job is upright and obedient is because you have set a hedge around him. You've protected him. You've set a hedge around his household and around all that he has. You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased. And Satan told God that if God, would remove his protection from Job and allow disaster to come on all that Job had, that Job would then curse God to his face. That's what Satan does. He accuses God's people. And that's what he's doing here in this situation with accusing Job before God. So God allowed Satan, the god of this world, to test Job. He allowed Satan to destroy or remove all that Job had, his family, all his possessions, absolutely everything that Job had was taken away. And he was afflicted with sores, a very sorry state of affairs. He was absolute misery. But Satan was not allowed to actually destroy Job himself. All these things came upon Job suddenly. Very quickly, without warning. Without warning, his entire world was turned upside down. And just like those who have lost their homes this year to fires and violent storms, wind, rain, and flooding, and so forth, just like those who have now found themselves in their homes surrounded by floodwaters, all of that comes so very quickly. We know that trials and tests are going to continue as they're going to continue to increase as we draw nearer the end of this age. Now, God may allow some of that to even happen to us. Some of us may even experience losses similar to what Job went through. A question that we need to ask ourselves is, are we striving to walk uprightly before God only because he has protected us? Are we striving to be obedient to God only because he protects us and blesses us? How well would we respond and hold up if we were put in a similar situation Job was? Will we love God and remain faithful to him for the right reason, out of a genuine love, which we show by our obedience to his word? Would we be able to hold up under such a situation? Well, Satan always complicates things. He complicates things in many ways. He accuses us before God, just like he did Job. Now, that word accuse is somewhat of a legal term. The words it comes from are somewhat legal terms. Talks about speaking publicly, in other words, speaking publicly before like a tribunal. So, you know, in a sense, he's publicly accusing God's people. Satan is publicly accusing God's people of various things. You know, he loves to point out our faults to God. He always wants to complicate things. In Revelation 12, where we just were there, verse 10 calls Satan the accuser of the brethren, who accuses them before God day and night. He's our adversary, and he wants to destroy us in any way that he can. He's the God of this world, and he has set it on a course for certain destruction if he was allowed to let that continue, or if he was allowed to continue to push it in that direction. For the sermon this afternoon, we're going to review the meaning of this day, the meaning of the Day of Atonement, and we're going to review what God has established must take place to finally set things right between himself and mankind, a time when justice will finally be served. The title of the sermon this afternoon is Justice Will Be Served. Justice Will Be Served. As I mentioned once already, today really truly is a very special day. It certainly is a very special day to God, and it should be to us as well as we understand or come to understand the significance of what this day really stands for, what it means for us personally and for humanity as a whole. I think probably most of us aren't feeling the day is really all that special right at the moment. And maybe some of you had the chance to read the article in our latest Discern magazine by Mr. David Trabig. It was entitled, The Holy Day That Satan Hates Most. And of course, it was a reference to this particular holy day. I found his introduction to the article somewhat humorous. He describes, as he was a very young boy, beginning to keep God's holy days. And he commented in his article, you know, that these are called God's feast days. And his comment was, well, there certainly was no feasting on this day. You know, as he suffered very much from his first opportunity to fast. Do you remember the first time you fasted? I personally don't remember. I can't remember the first time I actually did. But, you know, they say that traumatic events tend to be blocked out of your memory. So, you know, I don't know if that's with you people. I just don't remember. But certainly it does affect people in different ways. Well, this day pictures the fifth step of God's master plan. And these elements that this day represents are elements that have to take place. They all have to follow in progression through God's plan. It's through the events that are pictured by this day that mankind will finally have that opportunity to experience a right relationship with God without that influence of that evil one. He will finally be silenced, as Mr. Lydon pointed out. It's going to be removed. His influence will finally be taken away. He will no longer be there to trip us up, as he loves to do. So why is this day necessary? Romans chapter 3 and verse 23. Chapter 3, verse 23 tells us that all have sinned. And of course, sin requires the death penalty. All have sinned and come short of the glory of God. And in a sense, just like Eve, all of us have actually taken of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Each and every one of us, in a sense, so to speak, have actually taken that tree ourselves. So what is it that motivates man to take this course in life? Again, as Mr. Lydon pointed out, it's those three elements. It's the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. It's those three factors that Satan plays on the most. He plays on those things the most to distract us and try to get us to do things contrary to God's way of life. The three primary areas that he uses to entice us and to pull us away from what we should be doing. In an article entitled Removing the Cause of Sin, this was on our Life, Hope, and Truth website. It was posted there a year ago. It was written by Mr. Eric Jones. He writes that by taking of this symbolic tree against God's instruction, mankind has rejected God as the lawgiver and chosen for himself to define how to live. This approach becomes more evident every day as we look around the world around us, we can see that it really isn't working out very well. It hasn't worked out very well for mankind to choose his own way. We're, of course, fortunate here living in the Western world that country that we live in. We live under a form of government that we call democracy, and it gives us freedoms that many in this world do not enjoy. But of course, this is Satan's world. And man's form of freedom actually works against us in a number of different ways. Abraham Lincoln spoke some of his famous words. He said, he spoke about a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. The problem is that everyone wants something different. And when all want to govern themselves by their own rules, they're all continually in opposition to one another. So we're in effect, actually, we're trapped by our own system of laws. But actually, they're not our laws, they're Satan's laws. We recognize that we are continually moving toward greater enslavement in this country through our governmental system. Satan inspires our government and institutions to promote and accept practices that are contrary to God's laws, which then lead to sin, and of course, then that leads to death. And because we have thrown out the foundation of all moral guidelines, we are forced to allow one man's so-called freedoms to oppress others. So we have abortion clinics, we have so-called gay rights, we have alternate lifestyles, and of course we have a myriad of false teachings. You know, if a lie or a false teaching is promoted and repeated over and over and over again with force, eventually people begin to believe it and they accept it as truth and fact. I think we see evidence of that, quite a bit of evidence of that in our current political situation we find ourselves in. Freedom is true freedom only if it's in harmony with God's laws and coupled with that golden rule, which is to do unto others as we would have them do unto us. In our society, each human being has their own agenda. And because we stray from the correct guidelines, the correct way to live, and don't live by them, don't uphold the one true standard, the standard that is set by God's word, under this concept that everyone has an equal right. One person demands one thing and someone else demands the totally opposite thing. And so it's a no-win situation. You can't have it both ways, of course. And if everyone has equal rights to determine what is right and what is wrong, then contention and chaos is the only thing that results. Abraham Lincoln also said that nearly all men can stand adversity, but if you want to test a man's character, give him power. That's kind of a unique statement. Give him power and you'll test his character. You'll find out what his character really is. In the context of the subject today, the Day of Atonement, if you let a man have the power to decide for himself what is right, you will again see his true character. His true character will come through. Mankind has continually proven that on his own, he generally makes the wrong choices. And of course, then that separates him from God. Separation from God, man is driven by those three pulls, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. When man is apart from God, that's what drives mankind. So there has to be something that will heal this rift. There has to be something that takes place that will heal the rift so that mankind can get back to a right relationship with God. But it isn't just a man's rejection of God that makes this necessary, or that makes this day necessary. Satan himself, the accuser and the adversary of mankind, must be removed. He's got to be taken out of the picture completely. He has to be taken away. His influence has to stop. Otherwise, he continually manipulates us and influences us to do the wrong thing. We know, of course, that Satan is the father of lies. He's called the father of lies. He is the root of all sin. And because he is a very powerful spirit being, mankind cannot withstand him on our own. We just cannot do it on our own. So to begin to set things right, Satan and his influence has to be taken away, has to be removed. And today, then, again, pictures that time when Satan, who deceives the whole world, will be locked away so he can't deceive the nations anymore. In John, we won't turn there, but John chapter 8, verse 44. John chapter 8, verse 44. Satan, speaking to the Jews of his day, says, "You are of your father the devil. When he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own resources, for he is a liar and the father of it." Satan indeed is the father of all lies. He is more subtle. He is more sneaky, more cool and calculating than any other creature that exists in the world. King James Version of Genesis 3, verse 1, that's where we find that the serpent or Satan was more subtle. That word is actually appears there in that verse. More subtle than any beast of the field which the Lord has made. Satan doesn't want mankind to see him. He doesn't want us to acknowledge him, that he even exists. He likes to fly under the radar, so to speak. But much of humanity thinks of Satan basically as a myth. They're unaware of his real power. They're unsuspecting of his true purposes. It is well known that a principle of warfare is that you need to know your enemy in order to be able to fight against him and defeat him. Well, Satan doesn't want us to know him, and for that very reason, because we can combat him if we know about him and his methods in trying to destroy us. He is indeed that sly and cunning serpent who does always work in the background to manipulate and to control things against us. He is indeed the master of covert operations, and that's the way he works. Well, Satan is very subtle and deceptive, but mankind himself is also very gullible and very easily deceived. We know that Eve bought into Satan's lie, at least it seems very easily, or rather quickly, as you read the account. Of course, that we have just a brief description in the Bible of that situation, but it seems like she bought into it very quickly. The tendency is for man, who always thinks he knows best, you know, that's man's approach. He always thinks he knows best. He thinks he can discern and decide on his own what is best, or at least what is best for himself. And that's what Satan appealed to Eve with. That's what caused her to disregard Satan, or disregard laws, God's instruction, and to follow the temptation that Satan put before her. Let's turn to Joshua chapter 9. Joshua chapter 9. We're going to look at verse 1. Joshua chapter 9. The New King James Version has a heading over this section that says, "The Treaty with the Gibeonites." Now, you might recall this story of how Joshua and the elders of Israel were deceived in this particular situation, which led them to go against what God had told them to do. Again, you see this concept of how Satan does his best to inspire or to coerce mankind to go against God's direction and instruction. The situation in Joshua 9 is right after Israel's successful defeat of the city of Jericho and the city of Ai. Beginning in verse 1, Joshua chapter 9, verse 1, it says, "And it came to pass, when all the kings who were on this side of the Jordan, in the hills and in the lowland, and on all the coasts of the great sea toward Lebanon, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Canaanite, and the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite heard about it." They heard about the conquest that Israel had just made. "That they gathered together to fight with Joshua and with Israel with one accord. Now, when the inhabitants of Gibeon heard that Joshua had done to Jericho and Ai, they worked craftily, and they went and pretended to be ambassadors. And they took old sacks on their donkeys, old wineskins torn and mended, old and patched sandals on their feet, and old garments on themselves, and all the bread and their provisions was dry and moldy. And they went to Joshua, to the camp at Gilgal," camp of Israel at Gilgal, "and they said to him and to the men of Israel, 'We have come from a far country.'" So again, this is their deceptive approach. You know, God's command was to destroy the inhabitants of the land as they went in to possess it. Well, the Gibeonites wanted to convince Israel, Joshua and the Israelites, that they weren't their neighbors. They weren't from there. They were from a far away country. It says, "We have come from a far country. Now, therefore, make a covenant with us." And then the men of Israel said to the Hivites, "Perhaps you dwell among us." So they began to question. Maybe you aren't from far away. Maybe you actually are from among us. How can we make a covenant with you? Verse 8, but they said to Joshua, we are your servants. And Joshua said to them, who are you and where do you come from? So God's instruction to the Israelites was, of course, that they were to destroy these inhabitants of the land. The Gibeonites were their neighbors in that land, who actually were close by. They actually then set out to deceive Joshua and the elders, deceive them into, trick them into believing that they were from a faraway country. So the Israelites, rather than doing what they were supposed to do, relied upon their own resources. They took it upon themselves to decide. Again, there's that concept of taking of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. They took upon themselves, took their own initiative, on their own initiative, to decide whether what these men were actually telling them was true or not. They did not seek the counsel of the Lord, which is what they had been told to do. Joshua, who was the chosen one to replace Moses as the leader of the nation of Israel, was given the responsibility to go to the high priest and to seek counsel from the Lord in important decisions. But Joshua didn't do this in this situation. He totally disregarded that instruction. Let's look at verse 14. It says, then the men of Israel took some of their provisions, but they did not ask counsel of the Lord. And so Joshua made peace with them, and he made a covenant with them to let them live. And the rulers of the congregation swore to them. And it happened at the end of 3 days, after they had made a covenant with them, that they heard that they were their neighbors who dwelt near them. So again, the deception worked. The Gibeonites were able to trick the Israelites into making a covenant with them. And once that covenant was made, it could not be retracted, could not be broken. The lesson is for us is that we must seek God's help in important decisions in our lives. We do so, of course, by prayer. We do so by counsel, seeking counsel. And we do so by studying the Scriptures. Important lessons for us to learn. Let's look at verses 22 through 24, the same chapter. There it says that Joshua called for them, and he spoke to them, saying, why have you deceived us, saying we are very far from you when you dwell near us? Now, therefore, you are cursed, and none of you shall be freed from being slaves, woodcutters and water carriers for the house of God. And so they answered Joshua and said, because your servants were clearly told that the Lord your God commanded his servant Moses to give you all the land and to destroy all the inhabitants of the land from before you. And therefore, we were very much afraid for our lives because of you and have done this thing. So, of course, they had reason for doing that, but the point is that Israel, under the leadership of Joshua, decided to neglect God's instruction and to take upon themselves to decide what was right and wrong in the situation. And of course, they ended up paying the penalty for that. Well, this day, the Day of Atonement, is necessary because man has totally corrupted himself in every way possible. As a whole, humanity has no idea of what is right and what is wrong. They call evil good and good evil. And it's all comes as a result of throwing out, of course, the one true standard, which, of course, is God's Word. Today looks forward to that time, a time of great joy. It pictures a day when mankind will finally be reconciled with God, when the accuser and the promoter of all evil is finally removed so that he can mislead mankind no more. Today looks forward to a time when there will finally be harmony between God and mankind. Looks forward to a time when mankind will actually have a fresh start with God without Satan's influence. All those things were going to be made possible by two different factors. The first factor is Christ's atoning sacrifice, which was offered once for the sins of all humanity. So one factor that makes all that possible is Christ's atoning sacrifice, The second factor is the removal of Satan, of course, the enemy of mankind. And both of those factors are seen through the symbolism of this particular feast day. So what is it about this day that enables justice to be served? What enables justice to be served? Let's turn to Leviticus chapter 23. Leviticus chapter 23, this is the chapter of lists all of God's holy days. I'm going to begin in verse 1 of Leviticus 23, chapter 1, chapter 23, verse 1. There it says, "And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, The feasts of the Lord, which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations, these are my feasts." Now the word convocation there means public meeting or assembly. And as Mr. Mullen pointed out on trumpets, it can also mean a rehearsal. Convocation can mean a rehearsal. In our society, of course, we're all familiar with rehearsals, like, for example, a wedding rehearsal. We're familiar with rehearsals for musical performances or theatrical performances. Rehearsals are actually forerunners of the anticipated events. There are times when we review, if we're actually taking part in a rehearsal, we review the details and we practice those details to the point that we know that we're prepared that we can go through all the steps correctly. So as we observe God's holy days each year, we're in effect then rehearsing each of the major steps of God's master plan. So we have to go through this particular rehearsal, the events of this day, the Day of Atonement. They have to occur before we can get to the time that we're all anticipating and that are pictured by the Feast of Tabernacles in the last great day, that period of time of the great white throne judgment. We have to go through this part of the rehearsal first. Turn over to verse 27, Leviticus 23, verse 27. Verse 27, it says, "Also the tenth day of the seventh month shall be the Day of Atonement. It shall be a holy convocation." Holy convocation for you, you shall afflict your souls and offer an offering made by fire to the Lord. And you shall do no work on that same day, for it is the Day of Atonement, to make atonement for you before the Lord your God. For any person who is not afflicted in soul on that same day shall be cut off from his people. And any person who does any work on that same day, that person I will destroy from among his people. You shall do no manner of work. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations in all your dwellings. It shall be to you a Sabbath of solemn rest, and you shall afflict your souls. On the ninth day of the month at evening, from evening to evening, you shall celebrate your Sabbath." So there's the instructions, the specific instructions we are given by God for observing this particular day. And this Day of Atonement then demonstrates God's grace, his mercy that he wants to shed upon all of humanity. This day is about the fulfillment of God's plan to reconcile mankind to himself. So in rehearsing this day or the events of this day, then we afflict our souls and we are to make atonement. There's to be an atonement made for us before God. So the first instruction that we are given is, of course, is to afflict our souls or to fast. God actually mentions that in this section of Scripture. He mentions that actually three times. A very important issue with God. God, of course, does everything for a reason. So what benefit is there in fasting on this day? What might we see as a benefit of actually fasting on this day? Well, fasting actually helps us in three different areas when we think about fulfilling this day. First of all, specifically says that in the verses we just read that they were to do no manner of work on this day, including the preparation of food. So that allowed them to totally focus on the aspect of spiritual cleansing, which is part of what this day pictures. Let me read to you Isaiah chapter 59. Isaiah 59 verse 2 and 3. Isaiah 59, actually beginning in verse 1. It says, "Behold, the Lord's hand is not shortened that it cannot save, nor is his ear heavy that it cannot hear. For your iniquities have separated you from your God, and your sins have hidden his face from you, so that he will not hear." So one of the benefits of our fast is to let us focus our full attention on the spiritual aspects of this day. Understanding that our sin does indeed separate us from God, and that reconciliation has to be made on our behalf to remove that. Sin requires that a price be paid, and it has to be accounted for. Our fast then tells us, reminds us, that separation has occurred, and that that breach must then in turn be healed. Secondly, fasting helps us more fully recognize that we have to come to rely on God. It helps us understand that we have to totally rely on God and not on our own resources. Faced with deception all around us, we have to look to God for guidance to help us get through. Salvation, of course, is a spiritual matter, and only God can fix the situation, this breach that has occurred. Fasting helps us avoid and overcome the pitfalls of self-reliance. The pitfalls of self-reliance, of self-confidence, and of self-righteousness. So fasting helps us do all of those things. Helps us overcome this self-righteous attitude that often comes with our human nature. And finally, a third thing that fasting helps us with, it puts us in a humble frame of mind. Puts us in a humble frame of mind, the type of mindset that we must have in order to receive salvation. Fasting tends to slow us down. I think we'll all agree with that. It tends to slow us down. It gives us time to evaluate ourselves. It gets our attention. And if we work at it and use it properly, it can help us resist and fight the evil one. Fight that evil influence that is constantly being pushed against us. Now, we typically don't look forward to fasting, and that's exactly what Satan wants. You ever think about the fact that Satan really doesn't want us to fast? He doesn't want us to fast because it helps us draw close to God. And especially on this day, he doesn't want us to fast because this is the day that marks his end, the end of him. Satan, of course, is more than happy to let thousands starve to death around this earth, causing them to be malnourished and to only have the strength to focus on survival. He loves that, but fasting to draw closer to God, he hates. And when we're close to God, Satan then stays away from us. You know, by drawing close to God through fasting, Satan backs away. He stays away from us. He can deceive us into not focusing on the value of fasting or fasting with the wrong approach. He can certainly cause us to do that. Again, this is a reason that we don't sometimes view this day with anticipation, is because we do fast. We're sometimes more focused on our own discomfort than we are on drawing closer to God. You know, that thought process actually is motivated by Satan. We're more focused on our own discomfort. You know, this is a day to focus on what God is doing in his plan and purpose for humanity. Christ had fasted for 40 days when he was faced with the greatest temptation that mankind has ever faced. And that was a situation that Satan put him in. We're familiar with that account. It's in Matthew chapter 4. Also appears in some of the other synoptic gospels. But Matthew chapter 4, verse 1, talks about this temptation that Jesus Christ went through. Matthew chapter 4, verse 1. It says, "Then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And when he had fasted 40 days and 40 nights afterward, he was hungry. Now when the tempter came to him, he said, 'If you are the Son of God, command that these stones become bread.' But Jesus answered and he said, if it is written, or it is written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. And then the devil took him up into the holy city and set him high, or set him on the pinnacle of the temple. And he said to him, if you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written, he shall give his angels charge over you, and in their hands they shall bear you up, lest you dash your foot against the stone. And Jesus said to him, it is written again, you shall not tempt the Lord your God. And again the devil took him up on an exceedingly high mountain, and he showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. And he said to him, all these things I will give to you if you will fall down and worship me. And then Jesus said to him, away with you, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve. And then the devil left him, and behold, the angels came and ministered to him. So we see here that though physically weak, Jesus Christ was spiritually strong, and Satan at this point immediately left him. He immediately left him, even though Christ was pretty much on the point of total exhaustion. As we humble ourselves, God strengthens us. He lifts us up all the more. The spiritual principle that we find in 2 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 10. 2 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 10. Paul tells us here that he was made strong in weakness. Now, it seems counterintuitive to us as human beings, but in a sense then, when we are weak and we have to rely on God, when we put our total trust in God, we actually are strong in that situation. Verse 10 says, therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in needs, in persecutions, in distresses, for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong. Isaiah 58, verse 4, we find here the type of fast that God wants us to have. Isaiah 58, verse 4, says, indeed you fast for strife and debate, and to strike with the fist of wickedness. You will not fast as you do this day to make your voice heard on high. Is it a fast that I have chosen, a day for a man to afflict his soul? Is it to bow down his head like a bulrush and to spread out sackcloth and ashes? Would you call this a fast, an acceptable day to the Lord? That's the type of fast, the wrong type of fast that mankind sometimes can allow himself to become part of. Verse 6, is this not the fast that I have chosen? To loose the bonds of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, to let the oppressed go free, and to break every yoke. Is it not to share your bread with the hungry and to bring you to your house the poor who are cast out? When you see the naked, that you cover him, and when you hide, and that you and hide not yourself from your own flesh. So he's speaking here of the benefits of a right kind of fast. One that will loose the bands of wickedness. Well, hopefully these thoughts, we think about these things, it can help us not focus so much on our own discomfort here this afternoon. Think about the fact that as we fast today, we are actually resisting Satan. We're actually resisting Satan. You know, think about the fact that we're actually in a very great spiritual warfare. Every single day of our lives, we are in a spiritual battle. And as we fast here today, we're actually resisting Satan. As we rehearse the outcome or the events that this day pictures. Well, the second instruction that we have given in observing this day in Leviticus 23 is that there's to be an atonement made for us before God. An atonement made for us, becoming at one with God. And that's necessary, of course, for two different reasons. It's necessary, first of all, because the God of this world has blinded the minds of unbelievers so that they cannot see the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ. And the second reason atonement needs to be made is because humans have separated themselves from God because of the hardness of their hearts. Let's turn to Ephesians chapter 4. Ephesians chapter 4. Ephesians chapter 4, verse 17 says, "This I say therefore, and testify in the Lord, that you should no longer walk as the rest of the Gentiles walk in the futility of their mind, having their understanding darkened, being alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them, because of the blindness of their hearts, who being past feeling have given themselves over to lewdness, to work all uncleanness with greediness, but you have not so learned Christ." So we have to be reconciled to God. That which indeed separates us from God has to be removed. To reconcile means then to establish a friendship between. It means to settle, to resolve, to make compatible. In other words, to make complete and whole and right once again. Mankind, of course, sold himself into slavery. And of course, again, that is all a spiritual matter. And reconciliation is required then, that to be reconciled, to make atonement for us, sacrifice, the sacrifice of the Son of God had to take place to accomplish all of that. So there are two elements in the process of making an atonement of reconciliation. And those elements are pictured by the two identical goats that were ceremonially set apart, which we do read about in Leviticus 16. We're not going to turn there, but I think we're all familiar with that account. There it tells us that Aaron the high priest, who was the high priest at the time the account was written, was to wash himself and to offer a young bull as a sin offering and to make atonement for himself for his own sins. So he had to do that. He had to cleanse himself in that way before going into the presence of God at the mercy seat in the Holy of Holies. And in doing it in this manner, cleansing himself, he was serving basically as a type of the sinless Christ, who is our high priest, the Son of God, who goes before God on our behalf on a daily basis. On our behalf personally and individually, and also on behalf of all humanity. Aaron was then to take the two goats, and he was to cast lots to determine which goat was to be offered as a sin offering, which was to be offered as a sin offering for the nation, and which was then to bear the burden of the sins of the nation that would then be let loose in the wilderness. So he had to cast lots to make the determination. There's a lesson in that symbolism that is pictured by that fact, that casting of lots, it helps us to understand that mankind on his own is not able to discern. He's not able to tell the difference between the goats. Man must rely on God to show him what is true and what is false. We have to rely on God. That goes back again to the original deception that we saw that Eve fell under in the Garden of Eden. Under Satan's deception, he convinced her to take of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. He convinced her to take of that tree so that she would be wise in her own eyes and so that she would not have to rely on God. He led her into believing a lie. And mankind as a whole from that point on has chosen to decide for himself what is right and what is wrong. We know man's history, and it has proven out that man of his own resources cannot distinguish between good and evil. So we have to have God's help and his direction to receive that information and to understand the difference between good and evil. Well, the goat that was offered then as a sin offering at that time was for the ceremonial cleansing of the nation of Israel. And that goat, of course, represented Jesus Christ, who was sacrificed for the sins of all of mankind and ultimately for the spiritual cleansing of the entire world. Let's turn to Hebrews chapter 9. Hebrews chapter 9. Hebrews chapter 9, beginning at verse 11, Hebrews 9, verse 11, says, "But Christ came as high priest of the good things to come, with the greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is, not of this creation. Not with the blood of goats and calves, but with his own blood, he entered the most holy place once for all, having obtained eternal redemption." Again, that's a part of the picture, part of the symbolism of this day. "For if the blood of the bulls and goats and the ashes of a heifer, sprinkling the unclean, sanctifies for the purifying of the flesh, how much more shall the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without spot to God, cleanse our conscience from dead works to serve the living God?" We read in Revelation chapter 12, verse 10, that Satan is indeed called the accuser of the brethren. That next verse in that of that chapter says, "They overcame him," that is, they overcame Satan, "by the blood of the Lamb." Again, it all ties in with the symbolism of this day. Now, the goat upon which the sins of the nation were placed is, of course, representative of Satan. The symbolism of the two goats on the Day of Atonement picture the reconciling sacrifice of Jesus Christ and then the removal of Satan's influence on the world, the two elements of the atonement process, forgiveness of sin and removal of the primary instigator and cause of sin, that is Satan. The fulfillment of this day finally sets mankind free from all that has enslaved him. But we know, of course, that Satan doesn't go away without a fight. And so we have that fight yet ahead of us until the fulfillment of this day actually takes place. And we may usually think of this day on a grand scale. We think about the relationship of all of mankind as a whole with God. But this day, of course, also has great significance for each one of us individually. Great significance on an individual basis. Does this day help us draw closer to God personally? By keeping it and observing it, does it help us draw closer to God on a personal level? Sometimes we may not get as much out of the Day of Atonement as we really should because we're focused on our personal discomfort. We see a somewhat similar situation when Jesus Christ, who shortly before he was betrayed, he went up and he went to pray in the garden, and he took with him Peter, James, and John, his disciples. They went with him. When they got there, Christ left those three while he went off a little ways to pray. He told them to stay there. He told them to watch with him. But when he returned, he found them sleeping, and he woke them up. And he said, "Could you not watch with me 1 hour? Watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." It's found in Matthew chapter 26. Well, these three disciples were indeed weak in the flesh, just as we are often weak in the flesh. We afflict our souls for this 24-hour period of time, and it sometimes is very difficult, but is really a very short period of time in the overall scheme of things. Christ's instruction to combat their weakness was to watch and pray. In other words, to draw nearer to God and to build a strong relationship with him. That's what they were to be doing. Building a strong relationship with God. This day is very much about our personal relationship with God, and it should instill great hope within us. So let's think about what some of the positive results of this day really points to. What are some of the positive things this day points to? Well, this day makes possible what is pictured, of course, in the coming Feast of Tabernacles, where we will all, of course, experience a taste of that millennial rule of Jesus Christ, a very special time of year for all of us. Jesus Christ made the atoning sacrifice for all of humanity, making a correct relationship possible between us and God. He did for us what we can't do for ourselves. But we also, of course, have our part to do. And fasting is one aspect of what we are to do. But there's other things that we're to do as well. James, let's turn to James chapter 4. James gives us some additional initiatives of things that we are to do, things we need to do and put some effort into. James chapter 4, verse 7. James chapter 4, verse 7. It says, therefore, submit to God. That's the first thing we need to do. We need to submit ourselves to God, to draw near to Him. Put aside your own selfish motivations and pride. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. So fasting on this day shows that we're willing to put ourselves under God's authority. We're willing to put ourselves under God's authority. Verse 10. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and He will lift you up. He will lift you up. That's a promise that God gives to us. So we begin to see then what God does in turn for us when we do our part. As we noted in the beginning, we live in a very difficult and very trying times. This country has enjoyed the many benefits and blessings that were promised to the descendants of Abraham. But as time goes on, as a nation, we have taken those blessings for granted. We've not given God the appreciation and the thanks for them that we should, not considered Him as the source of those blessings. And as a result, we're now seeing those blessings beginning to be removed because of our national sins. This is what God had warned Israel would happen many thousands of years ago, warned them not to let that happen. It's important that we, as God's children, draw ever nearer to God as times indeed become more difficult. We do find some additional benefits that will be the ultimate result pictured by the events of this day. 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 6. 1 Peter chapter 5 verse 6. Here again we see Peter following through with the same approach and the instruction that we found in the book of James. 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 6, it says, therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that He may exalt you in due time, casting all your care upon Him, for He cares for you. Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Resist him. It's the same initiative we saw back in the book of James. Draw near to God and resist the devil. To resist then requires us to take a stand. And we can do that by putting on the whole armor of God, the armor that God makes available for us. So put it on so that we can face our enemy and then we can be prepared. We can be on guard against all that he throws against us. Verse 9 says, resist him steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same sufferings are experienced by your brotherhood in the world. But may the God of all grace, who called us to His eternal glory by Christ Jesus, after you have suffered a while, perfect, establish, strengthen, and settle you. Perfect, establish, strengthen, and settle you. Four areas in which God blesses us as a result of doing the things He tells us to do. After we have suffered a while. Remember Christ's question to His disciples? Couldn't you watch 1 hour? After we have suffered, after you have been tested, after you have done your part of drawing near to God and striving to resist, with God's help, the evil one, after we have gone through a little pain and discomfort by afflicting our souls, after our suffering, which is indeed but for a little while, these are the blessings we will then receive. Not only in the future, but ones we can actually experience right now in our lives. After this short period of time, this Day of Atonement, after this little bit of suffering, God promises, first of all, to perfect us. To perfect means to thoroughly complete us, make us whole. We can look at these four particular blessings in the context of God building His spiritual temple, which Peter described earlier in chapter 2. To perfect means to mend or to repair us, to make us whole. In the context of God's temple, it means to shape us as living stones being prepared to be joined together into the whole as timbers, prepared to be joined in perfect joints together with others. So that's one thing God can do for us. The second is to establish us. He promises to establish us. It means to set us fast, to make us firm. He can do this for us today in spite of the fact that we live in this ever increasingly evil society, a society that does indeed inflict suffering on us. In the context of God's temple, he resolutely and purposely turns us in a certain direction. He turns us in a certain direction so that we could be placed where he wants us, so that we all fit there perfectly. A third thing that he can do is he strengthens us. Strengthens us. It means to confirm us in spiritual knowledge and power. And God will give us the ability to succeed in all that we do for him. He will make sure that we succeed. Again, in the context of building a temple, it reflects God's binding and fastening us in every way so that there is no danger of our warping, of our splitting, or of our falling. He gives us strength for the position he has in mind. He does everything on his part to make sure that we will not fail. And finally, of course, he settles us. He settles us. That means to place or lay us on a solid foundation, a solid base. He gives us the peace and the comfort of a life grounded in his truth. To settle us is to cause us to rest evenly and firmly on the best and the only foundation so that we can grow together on that foundation as God's holy temple. In effect, then, to settle us is to make us steadfast and immovable. Wonderful things that God does for us. As the Church of God, as the Ecclesia, or the called out ones, as we observe the Day of Atonement and all of God's annual holy days, we receive many physical and spiritual blessings. All of these blessings can be realized right now, right this very day. They can be realized in our physical lives. We can be perfected, established, strengthened, and settled to a certain degree right now, with an even greater potential for spiritual fulfillment in the future. This is a day of many positive blessings, all resulting from watching 1 hour, so to speak, watching 1 hour with Christ. They result from enduring for a short time, not just this Day of Atonement, but enduring all the trials of our physical lives, which in comparison to eternity is really but a very short time. This day will allow all things to be set right between man and between God, between man, mankind and God. Atonement will be made for all of mankind. The source of sin will be removed, and humanity will at last have a chance to be at one with God, when Satan will finally be restrained and justice will be served.